Today's Taisho will be on case 57 in the Pianu, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 57 is entitled Joshu's I Alone Am Holy Throughout Heaven and Earth. Engo's Introduction. When you have not yet penetrated it, it is like silver mountains and iron cliffs. When you have penetrated it, you find that you yourself are the silver mountains and iron cliffs. If you ask how to do it, I would say that if you attain realization in the exercise of qi, you will occupy the pinnacle of attainment and will allow not even the holy ones to spy on you. If you cannot do this, see and study the ancients' doings as follows. Main subject. A monk said to Joshu, "It is said the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. It only abhors choice and attachment." Now, what are non-choice and non-attachment? Joshu said, "I alone am holy throughout heaven and earth." The monk said, "That's still choice and attachment." Joshu said, "You country bumpkin, where are choice and attachment?" "Right here. Show me choice and attachment." The monk was speechless. Secho's verse, "Deep as the sea, high as the mountains, the flies attempt to face the gale, the ant trying to attack the pillar, choice and attachment, non-choice and non-attachment, a cloth-covered drum that reaches the eaves." I want to thank everybody for coming here to practice Zen, to practice Chan, this beautiful spring morning. When I was leaving the house, I could hear the birds. I couldn't see them, but they were somewhere in the bushes and in the trees chirping. Really beautiful, yeah? It must be just wonderful to be a little bird sitting hidden in the leaves and chirping on a beautiful spring morning. And look at the sky, and beautiful sky. On the trees, all the leaves are just about to explode, just about to come out. It's really wonderful. Everything's, we say, coming to life. Of course, you know, winter has its own life, which is very beautiful. But this moment is so wonderful, when everything is just about to burst into leaf again, burst into flower. And here we are, sitting like birds in a bush, in the dark bushes. And maybe today something opened up inside of you. Not today, keep practicing. So here we are on this beautiful, beautiful day, and doing our Zazen. And the subject of our koan is the great master Zhao Zhou, called in Japanese Joshu. Some of you are new to Zen, and some of you have heard this story many times. But I have a great fondness, great love for Zhao Zhou, Joshu. He is, for me, one of the most inspiring figures in all of Zen. When he was about the age of Masai, he had a Kensho experience. He was about, he was like a high school student. And he had a Kensho experience, and it really shocked him. You know, most people go through life in a kind of dream state. They just do what everybody else is doing, and they just want to fit in. You know, that's only natural. And they get into the groove, and just keep going. You know, and it's a kind of collective dream. I think it's like a collective dream, and. Most people just stay in that dream until maybe something, a calamity happens, or until they become so unhappy that they have to break out of it. We don't really know why Joshu had his awakening experience, had an awakening experience when he was so young. But he did, and it was like being in a little room for 17 years, and then you open the door and you go outside, and you see the valleys and the mountains, and the big sky stretching out in front of you. This is like awakening. You know, you realize it's a much bigger world than we think when we're in the collective dream. And so Joshu went through that door. We don't know why, but he went through that door, and he had that, saw that great, you know, horizon. Life, you know, real life, the universe, the living world. And it blew him away. And he said, I don't want to go back to that little room where maybe he was unhappy, fearful, anxious, you know. So he saw something bigger. And he said, I want to live there. You know, I want to go there. So he asked around and said, where is there a good Zen teacher I can study with? And somebody told him about Master Nansen, Nanchuan. And so Joshu went to the temple of Nansen. He was quite young. And Joshu and Nansen were rather famous, I guess you could say, in Zen circles, because they became great friends. You know, I think the friendships we make in Zen are really special. When we sit together in, in heart, mind, sit together in Buddha nature, it's a kind of intimacy that's I don't think it's like anything else in the world. Joshu and Nansen had great, you could say, karmic compatibility. There was, they practiced better when they were around each other. You know, they felt more alive. They had joy, you know. And it was exciting to practice. So, you know, they practiced together for decades. You know, decades together. Until Nansen died. Everybody's going to die, you know. And Nansen died. And Joshu went out on the road in China, and he went throughout the Middle Kingdom looking for enlightened teachers. And at this time, Chinese society had great respect for awakening, for that experience of openness. And there were temples all over China, public temples, like public universities. And you could go to any public temple and study Chan, study the Great Way. And so people thought Zhao Zhou was going to just become abbot of the temple, and he eventually did. But first he went out on the road, and he had many encounters with great masters like Wang Bo and Lin Ji. He met them and practiced with them. It was an amazing time, all these deeply awakened people. And he also met a lot of people who didn't have much insight, like the monk in this this exchange. And then he came back to Nansen's temple, and he became the abbot when he was very old. He was in his 90s. He's supposed to have lived to be 120. And when he was quite old, he created the Mu Koan. So all, you will sometimes hear people say that Joshu's lineage, the Nansen Joshu lineage, went extinct because really after after Joshu's Dharma grandson, there were no people in that lineage. But actually, we're all practicing Joshu Zen, Zhao Zhou Chan, all of us. Because Mu is the core of our practice. So he was an old man, and somebody came in and asked him, does a dog have Buddha nature? And he said, ooh. So today's Taisho takes place during the period when, after his beloved teacher had died, and he was out on the road, and he went to a temple, and people knew about Nansen and Joshu. They were like legendary. And when they met Joshu, they heard, oh, this is the great Joshu. Let's see what he knows. Let's see. So sometimes they challenge him. Now, one of Joshu's favorite pieces of poetry in the world was the Shinshin Ming, the verses on the heart mind that we recite every morning at Sesshin, and that we recited today. The Great Way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. And so on and so on. When love and hate are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. Make the smallest distinction, however, and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. This was Joshu loved in this. So Joshu's going to a temple, and a monk at the temple said to Joshu, you're fond of those famous words, the Great Way is not difficult. And this is a little different translation. It only abhors choice and attachment. We say when love and hate are both absent. But maybe that's not the best of choice and attachment are both absent. He says, now what are non-choice and non-attachment? What Joshu says next is very strange. And you really have to be in deep mushin to appreciate just the flavor of what he says. Joshu says, I alone am holy throughout heaven and earth. Now, this is a strange thing to say. I alone am holy throughout heaven and earth. This is actually, these are actually not Joshu's words. These are actually the words of the Buddha when he achieved awakening. I alone am holy throughout heaven and earth. Now, you know, we understand when the Buddhists, or we misunderstand these lines when we know that the Buddha said them. Because when the Buddha had his great awakening, he was the Buddha. And he said these words, I alone am holy throughout heaven and earth. See? And so we say, of course, you know, it's the Buddha. Naturally, he's the holiest, right? Throughout heaven and earth. I alone am holy throughout heaven and earth. See? And so when a monk says, you know, you love these lines, the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences, when attachment and choice and attachment are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. And he says, so tell me about non-choice and non-attachment. And Joshu says these lines. He recites these lines, which are what the Buddha said. And that could seem a little shocking, right? It's like Joshu is saying, I am the Buddha. You know, I know what the Buddha knows. When last night, there's a person who has been sitting here in a very dedicated and consistent way. If you want to practice Zen, if you want to practice Chan, you have to be dedicated and consistent. If you do this once in a while, it has no effect. And sometimes people come here and they practice a little bit, and then they decide that there's something about this practice that speaks to them, that's very important to them, and they begin to be consistent. And they come regularly and they begin to practice on their own and so on. So this is a person who's been coming often, sometimes twice a week, even more, in the evening and after a hard day of work, you know. So this is a person who has a family, busy, hardworking, and comes here at the end of the day to do Chan, to do Zen. And I asked him last night, I said, how was your sit? And he said, it was wonderful, as usual. And of course, I was very happy, because that's how it is for me, you know? I was so happy that he had had a good sit. And I said, you know, I tried to draw out what had happened on the cushion. And he said, you know, this sitting, this meditation is really addicting. Yeah. He said, because I have so many problems, you know, all day long I have worries and deadlines and problems, and it's like tension, tension, tension. And he said, I come in here and I sit down on the cushion and it all goes away. Yeah? And he said, it's deep peace. It's like deep peace. And he said, it's the only time in the day when my mind is empty and this peace arises. Yeah? And I just felt like giving him a big hug. Because that's somebody who's really made great progress in his practice, you know. Even though we're very unhappy often, you know, ordinary life is like being in a pot of hot water, you know. It's just boiling and boiling all the time. And we ourselves are boiling and boiling all the time, you know, actually with fears and passions and dream, you know, ambitious dreams, so on and so on. And you know, a lot of people are, and I mean, you know, people seem happy, but actually, you know, a lot of people are very stressed, very tense, and to have a lot of pressure all the time. So this man came here, and he sat down on the cushion, and he felt like the water grows cool and still, you know, not boiling, but cool and still. It's like a refreshing cold drink, you know. And he felt, you know, energized and rejuvenated. And that's just wonderful. I mean, that's so important, right? And you know, it's possible. Well, the world, you know, the world is really kind of a crazy place. I guess you've noticed that. A lot of different things have happened lately that I think kind of show that, you know. I was, you know, this week I read with interest the story of the downfall of the governor of New York. Don't know if you followed that, but this was a person who I had respected very highly, Eliot Spitzer. He was a crusading Attorney General of New York, who really defended the interests of the people, I thought. You know, really, like, he was a true public interest Attorney General. He had a wonderful environmental record, and he went after Wall Street corruption. And he was like an avenging angel of justice, you know. And he just had this wonderful career of, you know, basically making the rich and powerful answer to the law. And, you know, he became governor, and he had something like a 70 or 80% approval rating. So everybody, pretty much, a lot of people in New York felt about him the way I felt about him. And so I guess you know the story that even though he has a wonderful wife and three daughters, it turns out that he has he spent something like $80,000 on prostitutes. And he was doing something which is illegal, which is going with prostitutes over a crossing a state line. And the interesting thing is that he was caught by the computer surveillance mechanisms that he himself had created. Isn't that interesting? And I heard somebody on the radio say, this is unbelievable. It's like he created this system. He must, in some part of himself, the person said, it makes me question his sanity. Yeah? And I actually agree with that. I think there's a, you know, it's a kind of a crazy world, and right now the United States is engaged in two major wars, and something well, just we have you might have noticed in the paper today there is a violence in Tibet. And the PRC, the communist government of mainland China, is cracking down on the people of Tibet. It's really distressing, you know. And the United States is involved in two conflicts. And it's really, I think, this violence is on the edge, you know, the world is boiling, you know, it's like on the edge, almost everywhere you look. And people are quite callous about this. It's pretty astounding. Last week, the New York Times had a review of a book that was called Human Smoke. And it's the word human smoke refers to the crematoria at Auschwitz and some other Nazi concentration camps. And the author is a man named Nicholson Baker. I've ordered the book. But Nicholson Baker has written this book called Human Smoke, and in it he says, you know, war is really terrible under all circumstances. You know, war is like always a moral failure, and we should avoid it at all costs. And he really wrote this book about how there's so much violence in the modern world. And he really is like an anti-war person. He really deeply believes that violence isn't the solution, that violence is the cause of all these terrible eruptions of insanity. So. And I thought it was interesting because the New York Times reviewer just trashed the book. He just said, this is ridiculous. You know, of course we need to have violence sometimes. Amazing, right? And I was so appalled by the reviewer that I went online to see if there were other reviews, and there was one in the Los Angeles Times. It was the total opposite. You know, so this just goes to show, if you say something, you have to be willing to put up with attacks, because this other reviewer said, this is the most sensitive and humane book I've read in a long time, and a deeply powerful indictment of violence. And that same, in the same week, you might have followed this in the paper, George Bush, our president, was speaking to some members of the United States military who were in Afghanistan. And he said, and I'm going to quote here, "I must say I'm a little envious of you," he said. "If I were slightly younger and not employed here in Washington, I think it would be a fantastic experience to be on the front lines. It must be really exciting for you, in some ways romantic. In some ways, you know, confronting danger, you're really making history, and thanks." So I've been trying to say that the world is a bit of a crazy place, yeah? And I rest my case with that evidence. So in a crazy world like this, and it's crazy at the top, it's crazy in the middle, and it's crazy in the bottom, you know. It's possible to say, well, these leaders, they're the bad ones, you know. The ordinary person, the average person, is good and decent and not crazy. Now look, people have a Buddha nature. They have an infinite loving kindness. There's no question in my mind about that. But they can get very confused, even like ordinary people. So anybody who thinks that only the people at the top are screwed up, and never met the members of my family, you know, and maybe the members of every family, right? So it's a crazy world, and we come in and we do our zazen, and you know, it's like coming out of a claustrophobic little room and opening the door to a big vista. Or it's like a drink of a cool, refreshing mountain water on a hot, muggy day, you know? It's just beautiful. And it's possible to say, you know, it's possible to say that this is so wonderful that the Zen is really about detachment, yeah, detachment. non-attachment. But you know, that's a one element of Zen practice. It's one stage in Zen practice, you know. But if you come in after a busy day and you sit on the cushion, often the tapes in your head start playing. It's like a movie's in your head. And you replay the events of the day, and maybe you have a lot of worries. So you sit on the cushion and you think, I got that B in chemistry. I've got to get at least an A minus in my chemistry test. Or you think, you know, if those car repair bills are any higher, I don't know what I'm going to do. You know? Or you worry about your aging parents, and that's a big worry. When my mother was in assisted living, it was incredibly expensive. I couldn't believe how expensive it was. And I have to tell you the truth, I sat down on the cushion many times and would think, like calculating, how are we going to do this? Then you go into, you watch your breath, and then at some point, it might take a lot of sitting, but eventually it's like a huge weight is lifted off your shoulders. So many people think that Zen or Chan is about non-attachment, see? And that is true, it is true in a certain way. Traditionally in ancient times, people who wanted to practice Buddhism often became bhikshus or bhikshunis. And they left their homes and they left their families, and they became anagarika, homeless people. So they lived an unattached life, and actually this is very necessary. You know, if you let, it's important to have a job and to take care of yourself, but if you let it, your job will take up all your time, okay? And you won't be able to practice. And if you have other activities or concerns or interests, they too can take up all your time. So this morning, for example, you could have had some pressing issue that you had to deal with, or you could have done something else, but you didn't do those things. You came here to practice. And this is a kind of detachment, actually. You know, when people became anagarika, they were saying goodbye to an ordinary kind of life. And even today, this is the case in much of the Asian world. It doesn't really end there. So I agree that practicing this path does require a kind of not just non-attachment but kind of detachment. You have to sort of put your priorities in a certain, or arrange your priorities in a certain way, or the kind of liberation you get from sitting will be out of the question. So that's a truth. But it doesn't stop there, because you come in and you're full of worries and stresses, and you sit on the cushion and you watch your breath, and it might take a lot of work. And you sit and you sit, and sometimes we're so frightened and we're so worried that it might take 3 sits, 4 sits, and sometimes you get off the cushion and you just haven't managed to liberate yourself. But every once in a while, you know, you sit down on the cushion and there it is, that it's that freedom, that openness. And it's so, it restores your heart, you know? It's so liberating. And it's like a charm, works like a charm. You know, so many times I've had terrible pressures myself, or at least, you know, in my little mind, they seemed terrible. I just did sit until that liberation came. I could deal with my problems. It's so precious. You know, there's nothing like it that I know of. But if you keep sitting, interesting thing happens, you know. Because detachment is an accurate description of the path to a certain point. But then something strange happens. You know, if you keep sitting on the cushion, you may eventually be able to break free from all of these cares and obsessions that go over and over and over. Should I do this? Should I do that? Is this good? Is this bad? You know. And eventually, your mind becomes clear and blank and probably dark. Yeah? And you feel like you're released. But if you stay in that state long enough, something very interesting happens, you know? Because you begin to feel the boundary between yourself and the world dissolving. It might not consciously seem that way. But you might get off the cushion, and you might go outside and see a little bird, you know, just sitting on a branch, like a little sparrow. And all of a sudden you feel like your heart is going to break. Yeah? And it's like inside you there's this tremendous love welling up for this like little bird. Yeah? And like joy and love. Or maybe you get off the cushion and you just see somebody here in this room. Oh, you see, it's so wonderful to see them. Yeah, it's so wonderful to see them. Yeah. It might just be very simple. You the bell rings, and then they serve the tea and the cookie, and you put that cookie in your mouth, and you think, God, this is a good cookie, you know? And you drink the tea, and you think, man, is this good tea? You know? And indeed, it is actually very good tea. I mean, like high quality, excellent Taiwanese tea, like the best, right? Very mellow. But you know, it's not just the quality of the tea. It's the quality of the mind. And it's not, you know, you could say, oh, look, you're becoming attached. You're enjoying your cookie, you know? Becoming attached, but that misses the point. See that? You have to give some things up to follow this path. There's no question. You had to give up your morning to be here, right? And if you're coming to Sesshin, you have to give up a week, maybe of pay, or of time. That might cost you in other ways. You might not get a promotion because you come to Sesshin. I don't want anybody to lose their job, you know, so please don't lose your job. You don't have to come to every Sesshin. But I'm just saying, there is a kind of detachment. And so that's real, and it's essential. Part of the problem for people like Elliot Spitzer is the inability to detach, right? Really, very tragic. When you enter that zero point, that shunyata, something amazing happens, you know? Because suddenly, all around you, the world comes alive in the most amazing way. I mean, it's amazing, right? You know, we go through our lives like sleepwalkers, and it's like you look at this and you look at that, and it's just like you're looking at an old movie that's a little bit scratched up, you know, an old film. And the colors are a little dull and so on, you know. The sound quality is poor. And we're just trudging through life, you know, trudging through life. But when you come in and you sit on the cushion, you know, you enter shunyata, that zero state, all of a sudden it's like the colors are brighter, cookie tastes better, tea is more delicious. And it's so wonderful to see people. You know, it's just like, I'm so happy to see you. You know, and if you, please don't think about it, just be happy. But if you did think about it, it would be odd, right? Well, it'd be odd. Why is this happening? Why am I so happy to eat this cookie? You know, it's because you are part of a bigger life. You are part of, you know, people misunderstand Buddhism so much. You know, when I was a kid, I remember I got interested in Buddhism when I was, you know, in college, so I wasn't a kid. But I got interested in Buddhism. And I remember I picked up the World Almanac, and it had the little summaries of all the world's religions, and it said that Buddhism worships the void, emptiness. Right? It's like, oh, whew, you know, who would want to do that? You know? But the thing is, when you're in shunyata, eventually you begin to experience everything as part of your life. You know, it's not like my personal life, but I'm part of like this big life, and I'm so happy to see you. Because when I look at you, I'm looking in a mirror at my own face. You know, it doesn't look like Kurt, you know. He has your face, but in my heart, it's like seeing the face of my mother, seeing the face of my father. You know, it's I'm so happy to see you. Right? And I see a little bird, and I think I'm so happy to see you. Because you know, I'm so happy to be you. You know, it's the most wonderful. The world is one life, and it's only the insanity of our culture and our system of living that makes that difficult to believe, you know? And we can think it intellectually, but that's no good. You know, you can read a wonderful book and say, oh yeah, I'm going to be affirmative about life, you know? But that's not how change really happens. You have to go down, you have to go to the roots. When we do Zen, we're going to the root, you know, the root of consciousness. And you get down there and you go to shunyata, to the emptiness that's at the heart of awareness, and then everything is alive. Everything comes to life. And it's whose life? It's your life. Your life, but it's my life. It's all like one life. So a monk said to Joshu, you know, you love that saying, the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. When choice and attachment are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. Now, what are non-choice and non-attachment? And Joshu says, one life. One life. Yes? In order to wake up, you must detach. It's true. You must be non-attached. You know, if you can't say no to some worldly concerns, you will not wake up. You know, and there's all kinds of pressures on your time and your energies. But that's one aspect, one stage. Ultimately, we're all attached, yeah? It's important to be attached in the right way. A gang of embezzlers are all attached, but not the right way, yeah? So we have to be attached in the right way, at the root, you know, with the loving kindness, yeah? He says, tell me about non-attachment and non-choice. And Joshu says, one life. He says, I alone am holy throughout heaven and earth. And by the way, that's what the Buddha meant. So he didn't mean, you know, I'm special and you're not. He meant, this is one, everywhere I turn, I encounter just one life. Buddha said, everywhere I turn, I am looking in a mirror and seeing my own face. Not my face which has a birthday and a death date, but my original face before my parents were born. That has no birth and no death. See? I alone am holy throughout heaven and earth. Everything I encounter is my true nature. Everything I encounter is my fulfillment and my joy, my happiness. Yeah. Okay. And the monk just doesn't get it. He doesn't get it. And he says, well, that's still choice and attachment. And Joshu could have said mu, but this is maybe pre-mu Joshu. So he says, you bumpkin! Your senses are so crude, you know. He says, get back to that cushion, you know, and get into Mushin. You're wet behind the ears, you know, kid. He says, show me choice and attachment. Come. He says, you aren't, what he really says is, you haven't gone to the roots. See? You haven't gone to the root yet. When you go to the root, everything is your true nature. I'm so happy to see you. I mean it. I'm so happy to see you. The monk was speechless, right? Good. Right? Good. Secho's verse, deep as the sea, high as the mountain, the fly's attempt to face the gale. You know, when we live in the small self, it's like a fly battling a hurricane. You ever have that feeling? You know? Do you ever get that feeling? You're like a fly battling the hurricane? Yeah. An ant trying to attack a pillar. Right? It's like, man, this is tough. You know, this person last night said sitting is addictive, you know, but no. Sitting is your true nature. It's refreshing. It's your natural condition. You know, it's hard to get up on Saturday morning and come to sit. You know, you have to get up early. You have to, you know, wash your face, and maybe you had to drive for an hour. What a pain. You know, so it takes a kind of it takes a kind of effort. It takes great determination. Really, to practice Chan requires great determination. You know? But, you know, which is harder? Sitting on the cushion in freedom and getting off the cushion and encountering your true nature everywhere, or being like a fly battling a hurricane, or an ant attacking a pillar? You know, I think it's an easy choice myself. You know, I think people, I'm so grateful to have this path. We all have trouble in life, but when you get on the cushion and you enter that freedom, you know, it's such a precious gift, right? And I can't help it. I know people suffer terribly in life, and there's often nothing like this for them, you know? So it's just like the relentless ordeal of worry and fear. Right? And a fly facing a gale, an ant attacking the pillar. So he says, you know, choice and attachment, non-attachment and non-choice, you know, please get beyond discriminating categories. A cloth-covered drum that reaches the eaves. Well, a cloth covered drum is useless, right? A drum is supposed to be covered with something that will bounce back and make resonance. So a cloth covered drum is beyond the discriminating mind, beyond good and bad, right and wrong. This is like a flute that has no holes, right? It's a drum that has a cloth top. If you can hear that sound, everything will be alive. Everything will come alive. So please listen carefully.